Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest is none other than Ruth Reichel. And I think she's one of the people in America that you really don't need to introduce, but I am going to introduce for all you young people out there who might not know the extent of Ruth's background. And she's on Chef's Story, and I want to point out to everybody, she's the first person I've asked to be on the show who actually hasn't made her life as a chef. But she did, I want to say, she was a cook, probably a head cook, at the Swallow Restaurant in Berkeley back in the 70s, which was a commune-type restaurant, but we'll go into that a little later. And then she was the restaurant critic for New West Magazine and California Magazine. She really came on the national stage when she became the restaurant critic and editor of the LA Times back in the 80s and 90s. And then she was plucked from LA by the New York Times to become the restaurant critic. And she did that for about 6 years. And then she was plucked again to be the editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine for about 10 years. And what she did at Gourmet, I think, really redefined the magazine industry. She is one of the people who have really shaped the last 25, 30 years of the food business. And she's an incredibly keen and experienced observer of chefs and their stories. So I'm so pleased to welcome you here today. Thanks.
I feel like they should see me blushing.
Well, after a cold winter, it's good to have some pink in your cheeks. Anyway, Ruth, let's get a little into your background before I started asking you about what I want to talk today is about, you know, the DNA of chefs and your take on it, really, from a historical but even a present position and knowing so many chefs. But like, give me a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up, and how did you even get into that first kitchen job in Berkeley?
I grew up in Greenwich Village with a mother who was seriously food challenged. I mean, she was literally taste blind. She could not tell when food was spoiled. So I started cooking very young. My parents were also big restaurant goers. I was the only child of older parents. And so I went to restaurants a lot as a kid. We didn't have a lot of money, but my mother loved to go. I mean, we'd go to the Four Seasons for a drink. And she would say, you know, look, there's a Picasso hanging on the wall. And then we would go someplace, and then we'd probably go to Zum Zum for dinner.
Right, right.
But she loved the theater of restaurants. So I always thought of restaurants as kind of magical places where you could be anybody you wanted for a little while. We also traveled a lot. My mother actually was educated in France, and my father was German and didn't come to the United States till he was 26. So they both had strong European roots, and we traveled a lot, not lavishly, but and my parents were strange people. I mean, my mother, we went to the Yucatan when I was 8, and our guide there had a daughter my age, and my mother decided it would be a great thing for me to live with them for a while.
Oh, so they left you?
They left me. They bought me a hammock and left me in Mexico and went off to Guatemala.
How did you feel about that?
A little strange.
How long was it for?
It was just a week.
But that's but at 8 years
at
old.
At eight. And these were very poor people. You know, we went to the market and we bought me metal plates and a cup and a hammock. And I hung my hammock up next to Rosita. And
did you like Rosita?
I liked Rosita. No, she was very nice. And then when I was 12, I was going to school at Hunter, and my mother was standing outside in January, in the middle of the year of my eighth grade, and she said, "We're going to Montreal," and put me in a French boarding school, and I never came home. And so I was at French boarding school for 3 years.
Wait, so did you want to go to French boarding
school? No, not at all. I called my parents weeping every night, begging them to let me. I didn't speak a word of French. I was a little Jewish girl from New York in a French Catholic school. It was very strange. But I learned French very quickly.
What did that add to your personality, looking back at it today?
Two things. One, I think, you know, I learned that you can overcome unhappiness. I was really miserable.
How long did it take you to overcome it?
About 3 months. And two, I really learned that you're capable, that I was capable of sort of anything that I needed to be capable of, that I could learn French, that I could make friends, that I could find my way through this very unpleasant moment with no help really from anyone. And I think it made me stronger. It's not something I would ever do to my own children.
Right. It sounds like they had a history of throwing you in the pool and say, swim.
They did. It's an odd way to grow up. But I think it either destroys you or makes you.
Yeah, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger,
yeah,
type thing.
Yeah. And also, I have to say, going to this French school, my best friend, ultimately, I mean, first we were mortal enemies and then we became friends, was this very rich girl who took me home to her parents in Ottawa on weekends. And so I, at their home, had my first, you know, real salads and, you know, really great camembert. And I learned a lot about food from Monsieur Ducroix. So,
did you have a leitmotif running through your life with food in those days? Because of the restaurant and this? What did you think you were going to be when you were in high school?
I never thought that. I mean, I did not know that I could have a career in food. If I had ever thought that that was possible, I would have considered it. But in those days, being a chef, for instance, was, I mean, you didn't know the names of chefs. You knew the names of restaurateurs. But the chef was was a blue-collar worker back in the kitchen, not a name. It wasn't anything that educated people
aspired to.
Or, I mean, my parents would have been horrified if I had said, you know, I want to go to cooking school, I want to be a chef.
But did you even want to go to cooking school?
If I had thought, I loved cooking. I mean, I always loved, I mean, I very, very early in my life, I pushed my mother away from the stove and said, let me cook. Mm-hmm. And I loved going to the grocery store. I mean, I remember having this feeling that I still have of being sent to the store to get something and thinking, I can buy anything I want.
Yes.
You know, this store is mine.
Yes.
And I've always loved going to markets. And, you know, I mean, I, for one reason or another, ended up going to college young at 16 and traveling around Europe when you could still travel on $3 a day, hitchhiking around when it was still safe to hitchhike around.
Yeah.
And it was all about food.
So what were the other things you considered doing in your life?
Well, you know, I grew up in my father was a book designer. And the thing I really wanted to be was a writer. But again, I didn't know that I was good enough to do that. And so the other thing that I really loved was art. So I studied art history, which I didn't know if I was going to do anything with it, but it seemed like the most fun thing to study.
Actually, you know, given what you've done in your life, that was probably, you've melded it all.
Yeah, I've been very lucky to bring it all together some way. I mean, these are, they're still the things that interest me the most, are food, art, and
that's why
writing.
You're still going strong and passionate, and, you know, you can, I think we're going to get into observing the last 25, 30 years. But I think we've both seen people who were phenomenal 30 years ago, and you say, where are they today, or 20 years? And it isn't just that they didn't make it. They made it, but they maybe got bored with it, or they've chosen another route. And you haven't, I haven't. Lydia was here yesterday. She hasn't. You have to keep the passion, otherwise you can't.
Well, I think we're really lucky in food, because food is changing so fast. And if food is your passion, there's always something new to do in food. Mm. That, you know, it's been a moving target.
It's like art and music.
Well, like art and music, yes.
Right.
And writing. But especially in food, you know, as we've come to understand that it's not just about restaurants, that, you know, there are all these other problems, that, you know, there's a political aspect to it, a sociological aspect to it, and the moment you think you've conquered one world, there's so much more out there to be doing and to be concerned with.
Mm. I think there's about 1 million hours of downloading to do on you. So we're going to take just one slice of your observations, your thoughts about when did you start noticing chefs?
I sort of started, I mean, when I got out of graduate school, I came...
You were out in California.
No, I came to New York.
Oh.
And I thought I was going to, like, become a curator somewhere. And, of course, I very quickly found all anybody wanted to know was how fast I could type. And had secretarial jobs and, you know, jobs that I really hated. And we were living in a loft on the Lower East Side. And I was just cooking all the time and going around and collecting recipes, because in the early 70s, the Lower East Side of New York was still, Chinatown was really vibrant, Little Italy was still really vibrant, the old Jewish part of New York was still there. And so I was like wandering around in my free time collecting recipes. And one day someone said to me, you're such a good cook, you ought to write a cookbook. So I wrote a cookbook at 22.
Oh.
It's a very rudimentary cookbook, but it got published. And then people thought I was a food writer. So when I went to Berkeley and...
Why did you go to Berkeley?
Because my husband is an environmental artist, and living in New York was just, it was too hard. And it was, New York in the early 70s was depressing. And,
oh, very. Drop dead. Remember on the New York Post?
And then a friend of ours was killed, was held up at noon.
Oh.
And shot and killed, and it just seemed like
lawless.
And we just thought, you know, we'll move to Berkeley. It's benign, and Berkeley was lovely, and we had really nice lives out there. And a group of us started a restaurant, and it was not a professional restaurant. It was like a bunch of us who liked to cook did this restaurant, but we made everything from scratch, and we were a collective. And I started, because I had written the cookbook, people thought that I was a writer, a food writer. And so when New West Magazine started, I went and said I wanted to write some articles. And suddenly the articles that I was writing, the thing that interested me was food. And the first big article they gave me to write was about the opening of Michael's restaurant in Santa Monica. And I sold them this article on the basis that it was the first restaurant in America that had 5 young chefs, all American, all under 25, all college educated, which in those days was just a shocking idea. So it was Michael McCarty and Ken. These are all people who went on with great careers. Jonathan Waxman, Ken Frank, Mark Peel.
Oh my gosh.
I didn't realize
Mark Peel was there.
Yeah. And I hung around that kitchen for a year because Michael kept running out of money and he couldn't open it.
How did you know about that restaurant? Because you're in Berkeley, that was in LA.
I knew about it because the wine writer for New West, and I was doing service articles, you know, the best ice cream cone in the Bay Area, that kind of, which is sort of how you start with magazines. And the wine writer for the magazine, Phil Reich, quit to go be the wine person at Michael's. And he started telling me about it, you know, this amazing restaurant that he was going to go work at. And I thought, I want to see this. I want to go down there. And so I went to my editors and said, you know, let me do this. And I think only because I was so cheap, I was so young.
And it was called New West. This was New West.
Exactly. This was, you know, this was California cuisine before anybody had even used the term California cuisine.
Right.
Walking in, I had done some little bits of interviewing chefs before for other articles I'd done. And the chefs were mostly not very articulate, mostly not native English speakers. And suddenly I'm around this group of really cool guys who are all my age. I mean, we're all in our early 20s, mid-20s. And, they're fascinating people. And so just hanging around in that kitchen was so much fun. I did not intend to spend a year writing an article for $500, but...
Why did it take a year?
Michael kept running out of money and stopping for a while.
Oh, so the restaurant hadn't opened?
The restaurant hadn't opened. I was doing this from the ground up piece about, you know, you've seen a million of these articles since then. I don't know that there were a lot before then.
Mm-hmm.
My idea was, if I hang around enough, they'll forget that I'm a reporter and they'll just talk.
Right.
And which is exactly what happened. I mean,
so what was the essence of that article?
I mean, the essence of that article was that they were doing something completely new, that they were trying to use American products, which was then shocking. That,
like what?
For instance, Michael wanted poulet de Bresse. And he smuggled duck eggs in. He wrapped them in chocolate and smuggled them in as candy eggs to start a duck farm.
Oh, my gosh.
There was a guy who was growing quail. I mean, that was in 1979. Laurie Chanel started the first goat cheese ever made in America. And they used Laurie Chanel's goat cheese on a salad. This was only 10 years earlier, the then great French chef in L.A. said, you know, California is a beautiful place, but when it comes to produce, forget it. I mean, you know, there weren't young farmers doing, you know, small local foods. This was just starting.
Let's take a little break here, and we're going to be right back. This is just too fascinating.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio's like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food, though. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today we're coming to you from the International Culinary Center. We're doing the New York Culinary Experience, and I'm so lucky to have Ruth Reichel as my guest. We finally got her here, and we're just talking about the very early days of American, the revolution in American restaurants. So let's get back to the DNA of a chef.
Okay.
Because we're attacking it only from this sliver. So, I think, was Jonathan the first chef of the restaurant?
No,
or did Michael consider himself?
No, Michael did not consider himself. The first chef was Ken Frank.
Oh.
And Jonathan was the sous chef. And Ken Frank left after 2 or 3 months to open his own place.
Uh-huh.
And then Jonathan moved in.
I see. So,
and then he was there for 4 years.
Right. Because he's the one who really, I've always heard, associated with the restaurant, probably because he was there the 4 years.
Yeah, and he really made it very much his own restaurant.
All right. So now, what is the DNA of a French chef versus the newly minted Jonathan Waxman? What was a chef before that? And on the plate to the consumer. And
so I think the biggest thing that these guys were doing, whether it was Jonathan or Mark or Ken, they were not working out of the great tradition. They were thinking out of the box. They were they'd all been to professional school, and they'd all worked in French restaurants to do stages in France. And they'd all, you know, slept in the hayfield somewhere and, you know, worked in, you know, some little restaurant in France somewhere for a while. But they came back with this real urge to do something new. Whereas I think up until that point, all of the great restaurants in America were copying something that was done in France or something that was done in Italy or something that was done in maybe Germany.
Mm-hmm.
These guys had a completely different attitude. It wasn't, in fact, Michael's menu, when it first started, was written in French.
Really?
Yes. Every word of it was written in French, and there was a Salade du Tournier that was a copy of some, but that quickly went by the wayside after a few months, and Jonathan started inventing his own kind of dishes, and he started really thinking about what would be the food right now that people want
to
eat.
And it should be pointed out, Jonathan went to La Varenne and he studied in Paris, and then he worked in French kitchens. So he came out of the tradition, but now he felt strong enough to break and you know, empowered enough to start doing an American cuisine steeped in classic technique. You know, he knew all the techniques of cooking, right?
Yes, he did. But, you know, he had worked at Chez Panisse for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So he had sort of absorbed, and he had sort of absorbed that whole, you know...
culture.
That culture of we can do anything, that sort of Berkeley idea of let's throw out the rule book.
Was he at Chez Panisse before Michael's?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, he was.
Okay.
You know, I mean, one of the things that nobody thinks about very much is, you know, everybody thinks of Spago as a very L.A. restaurant, but in fact, Mark Peel went and worked for a year in the cafe at Chez Panisse before he ever did pizzas at Spago. And Wolf sent him there specifically to learn how to do that kind of food. But there was a real sense of let's grill food, let's make it simpler. And the other thing that I think was really important change that these young chefs, these young American chefs, brought to the table was instead of thinking about how can we import the products that we need from France, they started thinking, how can we get people here to raise the food that we need? And as they started simplifying what they were doing, and as they started being able to get better ingredients, the cuisine got simpler and simpler and simpler.
Sort of like the French and the Italians. Like Italian cuisine, you can't do much to it. You have to, it's purveying, you know, getting the right ingredients.
Well, I mean, I always think of that as the huge change that happened in the 70s was that, you know, you had the Julia Child revolution, which was if we teach people technique, they can replicate everything that's done in France. And the California, the Alice, the Michael, the Jonathan revolution was, no, garbage in, garbage out. It doesn't matter how good your technique is, unless you've got good ingredients, you're never going to equal the food that you're getting that begins with great ingredients.
Okay, let's split hairs here, because I think Alice's biggest influence, mentor, was Richard Olney.
Yes.
Who was in Provence, in France, and a total devotee of French technique and loving that hierarchy. But since he lived in Provence, he was equally footed in going to the market and getting the best ingredients. So where did, you know, Alice, huge influence on chefs in that era. Where did she get that non-Julia, more product-oriented? Do you know where that came from?
Well, I mean, I think it very much came from just having traveled in France, having spent time with Richard Olney, and wanting that taste, and realizing she couldn't get that taste. I mean, if she didn't want to do the kind of, I mean, she didn't want to do a Lutèce. She wanted to do sort of simple Provençal food, and you cannot do that unless you've got great ingredients.
Right.
And so rather than going the route that people before her had done, which is let's try and import this stuff and we'll have, you know, 10-day-old mash, she said, you know, she actually had people in Berkeley pulling up their lawns and growing little lettuces for her. You know, for, you know, she went around and persuaded people that she would pay them if they would grow.
So you have Michael bringing in the duck eggs,
right? Yes,
and Alice bringing in the seeds. You
know? Yes,
yeah.
And then Alice discovered the Chino Ranch, mm-hmm. Which was down in San Diego, and it was suddenly like, oh my God, they have strawberries that taste like strawberries. Mm-hmm. And why do we even want to make a tart out of this? Why don't we just serve them the strawberries? I mean, mm-hmm. It was such an unknown flavor mm-hmm. in America right. at that point.
Right, something that had taste.
Yes.
What's the difference between Jonathan Waxman in those days and Roy Choi today? Has there been a significant change in who a chef is today, or is it just an evolution? Or do they have more in common or not?
Well, I think they have more in common. I mean, I think it's a very American idea of what a chef could be that then went, I mean, I think it's now jumped the pond and it's gone over to Europe as well, where the whole profession, the prestige of the profession has changed dramatically. So, I mean, the real difference, I think, is, I mean, these guys were really pioneers. It was very brave to want a career in food if you came from an educated family. And, you know, I mean, to tell, you know, for Jonathan to tell his parents that he's throwing out his degree in political science and he's going to go work in a kitchen. I mean, you did not get any support from anybody. I mean, you know, my parents, I mean, up to the point they died, kept saying, you know, when are you going to do something serious with your life? Forget about this food nonsense. I mean, when are you going to write a real book?
Right.
Today, there's so much support for the idea of being a chef. You know, I don't think anyone would turn on their kid and say, you know, oh, you know, you're going to embarrass us. We're going to be humiliated to say our child is a chef. But in terms of attitude, in terms
right. You know, this school is a perfect example. Philippe de Montebello's daughter came here.
Right.
You know, I can go on. Gordon Parks' daughter came here. We have so many, Samuel E. Jackson. I mean, you see the parents that come through here, and they're incredibly proud of their children being a chef.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Yes. And that's a huge difference.
Yes.
And it takes a huge confidence in yourself mm-hmm. to be a young person in the 70s saying to your parents, you know I have a PhD in physics, like someone like Robert Del Grande, and but now I'm going to open a restaurant.
Yes, back then.
This is what I want to do.
Right.
There was such prejudice.
So has food changed dramatically in the United States because of that educated class? Because I think it's still not that way in Europe. Maybe London a little bit, maybe England a little bit, but the rest of Europe I don't think have as many highly educated people doing this as a second career, or even as a first career, but with tremendous focus?
I think it's changed so dramatically that we have gone from being probably the country, the first world country in the entire world with the worst food, to the one with the best food. I mean, I think that what being in food means today is so different, and it's almost unimaginable how much it's changed in 40 years. And what it has done is it has given us the most sophisticated group of diners. I mean, not just chefs, but the people that the chefs have as customers are completely different. And that's a huge change, too. I mean, those chefs in the 70s had to educate their customers completely. I remember Jonathan once saying, you know, it's like, it's so exciting because I finally got customers who will just come in and say, give me something. But it's taken so long to get to that place where they trust us. And today, you've got an audience that's ready to follow chefs anywhere they go. So a Roy Choi, he has a built-in audience for people who want the kind of, like, exciting, you know, Korean-influenced food that he's doing. I mean, even 10 years ago, it would have been much, much more difficult for him to be as successful as he is.
Really?
I think so.
So you've been at the very top of a restaurant, of a magazine, Gourmet, which is arguably the greatest food magazine we've had in America. And we've had magazines a very long time talking about food.
Right.
And Gourmet well predates Michael's and Alice.
Yes.
So do you think the food revolution came about mainly because of chefs? If you had to point to one tipping point, was it because these educated young Americans went in to become chefs? Or what?
I would say two things. I would say chefs, definitely. I mean, so much of what has driven the American food revolution has been chef-driven. I mean, the farmers market movement, it came from, you know, people going to restaurants, tasting these amazing, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables and saying, well, why can't I get those? They're not available in my supermarket. So partly that. And I think television cannot be underestimated. I mean, the TV, what was then called the TV Food Network, when they started putting chefs on television, what they did was attract young people, mm-hmm. make young people want to cook. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, has been so many people whose kids grew up watching food TV, mm-hmm. cooking. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's been... I wish I could say I thought the magazines had been drivers, mm-hmm. but, you know, I think we were shamefully far behind. Mm. You know, I think...
I don't know if you can say shamefully behind, because the people that were interested, it was one of the only outlets to get information. And it was still kind of elitist to eat fancy food. And where could you buy it in your supermarket, right? Well, and so it's kind of chicken and egg type thing, you know.
Well, maybe, but I mean, magazines, yes, but you know, newspaper food sections. Which I mean, at the point where I became the food editor of the Los Angeles Times, that was the cash cow of the newspapers. I mean, this was when supermarkets were still in huge competition. Mm. We had 60 to 100 pages every week in that section. And
60 to 100 pages it was of
two,
the food.
It was two sections. I mean, when I took over that section, we had our own kitchens. We had our own photo studio. We had a large staff. And I think the proudest thing I've ever done was push the paper to change the food section from something that ran, you know, canned recipes from Coca-Cola and Campbell's and you know, General Foods to... Let's talk about ethnic foods. Let's walk these neighborhoods. Let's talk about how people on food stamps are faring. And So you had these, I mean, Craig Claiborne was doing really great stuff in the New York Times, but there weren't a lot of food sections that sort of took that pulpit and ran with it and said, you know, this is a real way to talk about, you know, what your neighbors are eating, what's really going on, right. Yes.
Okay, we're going to take another little break here, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Chef Story, and today my guest is Ruth Reichel, and we're really tiptoeing through history here of what has brought us the modern chef. So how would you define the chef today? You know, do you have let's say somebody comes from deepest Africa and doesn't know anything about our food culture, and you wanted to describe what a modern American chef was. How would you do that?
I would say that a modern American chef is someone who is really passionate about food and really wants to feed people his interpretation or her interpretation of the best food that he or she can possibly imagine, and that they are people who of great imagination, great technical ability, and big thinkers, big idea people.
Do we have the most educated chefs in the world?
I think we do. I mean, I think that, you know, if you think about the people who are out in the forefront of the food movement today, they're unlike the chefs in most other parts of the world. They're people who've had a lot of experience, who've been, you know, not just to culinary school, but they've traveled, they've read.
They have degrees.
and they're interesting people. I mean, I think what I've always loved about people in food is, I think it's very hard to be a great chef and not have a generous soul. I mean, I think there's a kind of generosity in wanting to feed people. And, you know, one of the things that I love about the new movement is that this generation of chefs also feels a real need to change what's bad about the food systems in the world. I mean, there's a lot of, which is, I think, very new. I mean, there's a real emphasis on, you know, hunger is really our issue. And the fact that, you know, 1 in 8 people in the United States goes to bed hungry is, it's something that chefs have embraced and said, you know, this should not be happening in our country. Mm-hmm. I think that there are people who understand in a way that chefs, I think, in other parts of the world don't, that eating is an ethical act, mm-hmm. and embrace that notion. I mean, I'm mm-hmm. so proud of the kinds of things that chefs are doing, which is very new. But, you know, I mean, when I started writing about restaurants, there was no Second Harvest. I mean, it was chefs who started saying, like, look at the waste that we've got. I mean, I remember Wolfgang Puck, you know, complaining about the amount that they threw out and saying, you know, we've got to do something about this. Mm-hmm. Or if you look like at an organization like SOS, which is, like, you know, totally restaurant-based. Mm-hmm. So I think that the American chef has a much broader vision than chefs in most other countries who are, you know, mostly small business proprietors and don't think in larger terms than that.
True. I mean, look how many chefs have written books.
Amazing books.
Amazing books.
Amazing books.
Amazing books. And it's wonderful. You know, their communication and articulation are two incredible gifts, because you can have talented people, but if you can't communicate it outside of the realm of exactly what you do. So a chef can only cook for so many people, and it's localized. You know, maybe they have a lot of restaurants, but basically they've been contained. But by having the avenue of articulation and communication, being able to write, being able to speak, and now with technology, it's not just what they put on a plate.
No.
What they think.
What they think. And they think so big. I mean, you look at someone like Dan Barber, who has this amazing book coming out that, you know, I read that book and I think he's got the most curious mind of anybody I've ever met. He just keeps asking, why? Where did this come from? How did it happen? I want to investigate this and I want to tell the world about it.
That's right. That's right. I know. I love him. okay. So to move this along, what do you think is going to be, what is the chef of the future? What are the challenges for a chef of the future in your...
Well, the big challenges really for the chef of the future is the food supply.
Yes.
Which is in terrible danger.
Right.
And, you know, right now, I mean, you worry about the food, the huge amount of food that's coming from China.
Yes.
You worry about the fact that there's a drought in California, which, I mean,
it's worry. The food basket of the United States.
Yes. You worry about, the way our meat is being raised. You worry about the prices of food. I mean, I think those are ultimately the biggest challenges. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited about the fact that so many chefs are now involved with the idea of teaching children to eat,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, eating is learned behavior,
mm-hmm.
and we need to teach people to eat a lot better mm-hmm. than we've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, that's a huge challenge. If we don't want to have, a system where only rich people eat well,
mm-hmm.
And if we don't want to be inundated by fast food,
mm-hmm.
We really have to do something and have to do it quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Those, to me, are,
I think,
the big challenges.
You know, I don't usually harp on this, but I think we need to address it. There's been a lot of criticism that women don't get enough press as being chefs. I guess it was the Time magazine cover, and there were three guys on the cover. So my first question is, if you had to pick the top three chefs in America, would they all be men? Was it fair to put those three on? Forget their gender. Did they get there for other reasons? And then what is this whole question of women chefs? Do you feel like they've been ignored?
Okay, let me take the second question.
Okay,
first.
Sorry.
Because I think that one of the things that's really interesting about women is that our DNA is maybe different than men, and maybe there are as many women chefs as men chefs, but they're not going into it for fame. They don't know how to promote themselves that well or don't even care about it as well. And so I think that women, I think if you look around, you'll find that there are lots of women chefs. But that maybe their goal isn't to be the most famous person on the block, but just to feed people really well and have a good business. So I think, you know, we have to like redefine what success is. We're a fame obsessed society, but, if you have a little restaurant that, makes a good living for you and your employees and feeds your customers well, isn't that success?
That is, but I think more than ever, chefs, at least in New York City, and I think in big cities, you have to do PR now to get people in your restaurant. The competition is so fierce. And it's one of the things that's it's like the necessary evil that you've got to do. I know so many male chefs that are shy, and don't want to do it, but they hire a PR firm or they feel they have to do things to get their name out there. And one of my questions is, I don't even remember who the three guys were on the Time magazine cover. But the question is, I think it's a hard question, and being two women, I think we can put it out there. If you named, Dan and Alice, You know, right. Alice earned her stripes. She's there. No one questions it. And Dan with sustainability, the two. If you said sustainability, Alice's name would come first.
Well, even if you didn't say sustainability, I mean, I think the idea of talking about the most famous chefs, I mean, Alice isn't a trained chef in that sense, but she probably has done more to change the way Americans eat in restaurants than anybody else out there.
Probably, yes. And if you said organic, sustainable, her name would pop up first, and I think Dan Barber's would come up second, probably, in this country. So if I said barbecue, I can't think of a woman that would pop up there.
No, I can't.
Okay.
I can't.
So if you said fusion.
There are plenty of women doing fusion.
But no, I'm not saying Mama Fuko comes to mind. You know, I'm not even sure. That is kind of his Japanese, you know.
Yeah, right.
So David's Mama Fuko, and maybe Roy Choi doing kimchi tacos.
Well, I mean, really, though, if you're going to say fusion, the first person that comes to mind is Wolfgang Puck, because when he did Chinois, it was nobody had ever done that before.
All right. Classic elegant.
You think of Eric Ripert, you think of Daniel Boulud, you think of Jean-Georges, you think of Thomas Keller. It's hard to think of a woman who does that kind of...
If you say regional French great bistro, not even regional, but bistro wonderful.
Well, Suzanne Gowen.
And Gabrielle.
And Gabrielle Hamilton.
I think that there are in...
Well, you know, of course, here's the other thing that happens, which is that the media in this country is enormously New York-centric.
True.
So, part of what happens is that you think of New York restaurants.
Yes.
I mean, because I lived in California for 20 years before coming back to New York, I think about California as well, and, you know, and I think of, like, the whole West Coast, and you've got, you know, people doing really amazing women working on the West Coast, much more than in New York, actually.
All right, so let's open it up to the country, or even Chicago, or New Orleans.
New Orleans, you have Susan Spicer. Still, you know, if you're the media, and if you're going to do a cover about great food people, it's your obligation to try and get diversity, both gender diversity and racial diversity. I mean, to me, that time cover is a failure for no other reason.
Well, that's true. I'm not going to. I just want to put on. I guess the big question, and when people say there were no women on that cover, I don't think they meant because they should include diversity. I think a lot of people were saying because women just in their own right belong there. These weren't the three greatest chefs. So my question is maybe what proportion of the great chefs, if we said here are the 200 most innovative, delicious, you know, give that kind of background to the chef, what percentage of them would be women? And I have to say here, and I presented this at the Cherry Bomb last week, that in 1984, when we opened the school as the French Culinary Institute, we had 31% women.
Right.
That was quite high back in 1984, quite frankly.
Right.
Today, we have 61% women in the school. And we probably went to 50% about 10 years ago. And so... And I will do everything I can to empower women. And I think Julia Child was like, she was incredibly great with empowering young women in the field. The question is, if they're not obviously 50%, you know, and for 10 years putting out women, why? Is there another reason? It's not that they couldn't be. I mean, some of the greatest chefs we've ever had graduate from this school. I remember a young Daniel Boulud. This had to be 25 years ago. And, you know, when we do our finals here, we invite the outside chefs to come in and be the judges.
Right.
And Danielle came. And we had a quail dish done by this one student. Every student, you know, did four. And you got judged on presentation and taste. And he gave it 99 points.
Wow.
And he said it was the best quail he had ever eaten. And he said, and I'm going to hire that woman. He didn't know it was a woman. I'm going to hire that chef. And in those days, all the French chefs were all men. And he wasn't prejudiced at all.
Right.
But when she came out, she was 9 months pregnant.
Oh.
And she gave birth that night.
Oh, my God.
So I say to any guy who's graduated from here, top that.
Really? Oh, my God.
Oh, my. And so I think that that says that that woman has the capability of doing anything and doing it brilliantly. So it's not that women can't be the top chefs. Why aren't they? And is it money that they can't get the backers? Is it because of the mommy issue that they want to, pull back on their careers in a very vulnerable time in their 30s and 40s because they're trying to do two things, juggle two things? I think there's a lot of external reasons why women might not be there. And I think as women, we have to be very upfront and, confront those, because maybe we can do something about that to alleviate.
I think it's all of those things. I mean, I think that the notion that, behind every one of these big deal chefs, the chefs with empires, is a money person. And they're all men.
Exactly.
And we need the very rich entrepreneurial women to step up and back women restaurateurs. We need a female Phil Suarez.
Why don't we start a women's angel group?
We should.
Okay, we will.
Yes, okay.
All right,
yes.
We're going to end on that note. And all you women out there who listen, who if you don't have the money to start the angel group, you must know somebody, especially you women chefs out there. So let's get this thing started, because we do need to help our sisters.
We do.
Thanks for coming today.
This has been fascinating. I could talk for hours.
Come back.
I will.
All right. Well, thank you for listening today. And I want to do a shout out to Robin Cohen and to my producers at Heritage. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.